where do people go wrong with cat mounts?
So if you order a mannequin and you mount on that mannequin without doing any facial alterations, you're probably not going to be happy with it.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I've seen so many cats in my life that, you know, run hounds, and I've seen hundreds of them.
Yeah.
And I've mounted hundreds of them now, but they have, I think the ones you're talking about that you see, you instantly don't like it.
Yeah.
Are, they have that, like, deer in the headlights look, or,
yeah,
you know, they don't get the brow over the top of the eye, which, when you think about it, those cats are constantly fighting. They need that early detection of a SWAT, so their eyes are not bugged out.
Right.
They're in.
Yeah.
And the eye width. Seems like most of those mannequins, the eyes are too far apart. And I'll cut it and I'll move it.
These are stories of outdoor adventure and expert advice from folks with calloused hands. I'm James Nash, and this is the Six Ranch Podcast. In the United States, there are about 15.2 million hunters. That's how many hunting licenses we sell in the country. And they spend around $21 billion per year, which breaks down to an average of $2,800 per hunter. Now, we need to be really smart about how we spend that money. You can't spend it on stuff that's going to break. Otherwise, you have to buy something else again, and you end up costing yourself even more. We also need to be smart about how much weight we carry in our packs, because that's a serious limiting factor. One way to remove about 5 pounds out of your pack without sacrificing your ability to find animals is to get rid of your spotting scope and tripod. Now, there's a time and a place for those things, and I carry both of them a lot. But if I need to go lightweight, I'm going to carry stabilized binoculars. And the best stabilized binoculars I have ever used are from Sig Sauer. They are the Zulu 6, and they just came out with a new pair called the Zulu 6 HDX. I use the 12 power magnification model. They weigh 21.5 ounces and they have two modes of stabilization. So you throw the lever forward once and that's going to stabilize the image. If you turn it off and turn it back on again, that's going to stabilize it even more. And I'm not kidding. It is more stable than if you're glassing from a tripod. It is absolutely incredible. You're going to be able to see stuff at just incredible distances and really break it down. Like, you're going to be able to tell the difference between a billy and a nanny mountain goat at a mile. You're going to be able to actually see if there's a kicker coming off that 4x4 muley that just popped up over the hill. They work great at early and last light. They work great at high light. They fit really well in my hands. Like, this was one of the first products that I asked Sig to make when I started working with them. And to no surprise, they were already on it. They were way ahead of me. But this is a really good piece of gear. I highly encourage you look into it. You can go to sigsauer.com. Look for the Zulu 6 HDX. Comes in a few different magnification settings, but the one that I like the best is the 12 power. Check it out. That's the big debate about morels, is how fast they grow. And people say, oh, they grow overnight.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's true.
It's not. Because I was there two days ago, and they were all tiny.
Yeah.
And I thought, man. And, you know, you waste the gas to go out there. I'm going to pick some.
Uh-huh.
And then I thought, I'm going to give them. And I started talking to some people, and my son Nick.
Yeah,
he's like, no, I've seen them in the road grow like an inch a day. And I'm like, all right. So I went back out there today and I picked a ton of them, but they're all tiny.
Huh.
So I don't know.
It'd be interesting to throw a coffee can over the top of one so that you could come back and, or even put a time lapse over it. I'm sure this is done. I was just talking about this the other day, but there's a group in Denmark who I've tried to get on the show and they won't do it, but they figured out how to farm morels.
Really?
And they're doing it year-round. And, you know, they've got these basically like raised beds that are just wall-to-wall morels. So they're able to produce them commercially.
Well, up until a couple of days ago, trying to justify the gas, going out getting firewood, I'll look for mushrooms.
Yeah.
And my total was, I think I was up to 11 mushrooms in three trips out there. And it's like, something's weird this year.
It's been a tough year.
And then I got in a burn.
Uh-huh.
And you could see where that burn, then didn't, burn, didn't. I never found one mushroom out of the burn.
No kidding.
And they're just exploded in that burn.
Wow.
So
Isn't that crazy?
I'd like to know why. What that does to them.
Yeah. I mean, there's so much we don't understand about fungi and mycelium, but, you know, my basic understanding is that the mushroom that we pick is the apple off the tree, and the mycelium covers these huge amounts of distance and are communicating nutrients to portions of the soil that need it more. And they're doing wonderful things. I think fungal intelligence is something that's really interesting. Did you see the video about redesigning the Japanese subway systems with fungus?
No.
They made a map of the city in a maze, and then they put grains at the subway stops, and the grains were what the mushroom wanted to eat. And it was a spongiform mushroom, and it would go through this maze, and first it found them, and then it reorganized itself and developed a more efficient route for getting to all those subway stations than the Japanese engineers could come up with on their own.
That's brilliant, whoever thought that one up.
Yes.
I mean, it's like an aspen grove. They say, you know, most of that's underground.
Right.
And I assume those spores are all connected.
Yeah. Yeah. Sure are good to eat, though, aren't they?
Oh, yeah. I don't know if I've ever sold a mushroom.
Yeah, I haven't.
And so, you know, a deal like today, I'll just be giving them away. I should have brought you a bag.
Oh, that's all right. That's all right. I'd have just drowned them in butter and ate them.
Uh-huh.
What do you know about the history of taxidermy? When did this get started?
So, you know, it's kind of a strange, I call it an art, but, you know, if you, any scary movie on Hollywood movies or all, if you look in the background, there's taxidermy hanging there.
Yeah.
It's we have this cloak on us that, we're strange, you know, we play with dead animals.
Yeah. You're animal morticians.
Yeah. But back in the old days, the terminology stuffing, you know, I'm going to get that stuffed. Well, they did.
Yeah.
They didn't have forms like they do nowadays. And they would take a 2x4 armature, like for the neck going up and the head, and stuff it and literally sew that. And you can see a lot of that, like Imnaha Tavern.
Yeah.
It's got some of that down there, but.
And they kind of look like a sock that you crammed a bunch of something else into.
Yeah, they got the bug-eyed look.
Uh-huh.
So anyway, that's the old way, and they were neck mounts.
Yeah.
They didn't have the shoulders on
right.
them. And
yeah, that's the classic that you see is just like a little curve of the neck coming up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's really just gone crazy with the art. People sculpting, and very good sculptors sculpting these animals, and it's nowadays a taxidermist can just get his measurements right, call them up and order it, and it's pretty darn close.
Yeah. Close, but there are some real differences that happen with good taxidermists, and I want to get into that later. But did you work at the sawmill?
I did.
What was your job there?
I started out on the green chain, piling lumber.
Which is a tough job.
Yeah.
Yeah. What is pulling green chain? What's that mean?
So everything that's coming out of that mill comes down a sorter, and it's all segregated with steel to bins. Like, it'll pop it out for length, and so you have all these bins down there that you're dealing with, and you just all go. We'd switch day shift, night shift every month, and so be out there 1 o'clock at night, and you're just got to get on that bin, and then it depends on what the head rig's sawing.
Yeah.
You can kind of predict it, but if they're in little lumber or little trees, you get piled up with the 1x2s, 1x4s, 1x6s, and then if they're in the pumpkins, then you got the big heavy shop, and
yeah,
they call it shop. It's 5/4, so 1¼ inches thick, and 16 feet long.
So you're grabbing those boards as they come down with your hands, and then putting them on the stacks that they need to go on.
Yeah, there's a pivot. They'll come down on a bin, and then there's a pivot there that you grab one end of it and you put it up there, and then you get your weight into it, and you get pretty catty at it.
Yeah,
bouncing it over there, and you sticker every layer mm-hmm. so they can dry. And yeah, I did that 12 years.
Did you end up working on the head rig at some point?
I did,
because my memory's not great, right? I'm missing a lot. But now that we're talking about it, I remember visiting Dad because he worked at the pond.
Yep.
And I remember you talking about, as these logs would roll in, how you would size them up and figure out what you were going to cut out of them and running that head rig, and just thinking that was the coolest thing in the world.
It was, you know, your dad was on the pond. That was the first step.
Yeah.
And then there's the barker.
Yeah.
And then there's the head rig and then the edger and resaw, trim saw, all those different stations. And towards the end of that 12 years I was there, I was doing what they call oil and relief. Mm-hmm. And when everybody else is off taking their lunch break, I'd be oiling everything. Mm. And then I'd go around and give everybody a 15-minute break. So
okay.
I got to learn all the stations.
That's
that
cool.
Way. And yeah, not monotonous. It was pretty, the best job I thought down there. But
you are an artist in every sense of the word, in my opinion, and you belong to a class of people that is very rare, and it happens to be my favorite class of people, in that you work really hard. You work really hard at everything that you do, and you have as long as I've known you. But you also transition from this, you know, bloody hand, blue collar stuff into fine art. And there's just not very many people that have the brain that allows them to be good at both. And I think that makes you really special. And I want to brag on you a little bit. I was able to accomplish a lot of what I wanted to as a wrestler, you know, all the way through school and going through high school. But the one thing that I didn't do that I wish I would have was won the Joe High tournament.
It's a tough tournament.
Tough tournament. But the prize of winning that tournament was better than anything else, because you made all of the brackets for everybody every year. Those were incredible.
Yeah, you know, that tournament was open to 1A, 2A, 3A. It was tougher than state.
For sure. For sure. So if you won the Joseph High School Wrestling Tournament, that was a big deal. And there was, like, you're going to state, you're going to probably end up on the podium at state. But, man, those brackets, and for those that don't know what I'm talking about, when you enter a wrestling tournament, there's a meeting at the beginning of the tournament to figure out where you're going to be on the bracket. And they try to put, you know, who they think is going to be the best wrestler and the next best wrestler on opposite ends of the bracket, so that they're not meeting each other too early.
Yeah.
And, you know, you're trying to figure out who's going to be the best at this weight class. And I don't even know how many weight classes there were. You probably do, because you had to make them, but
14
weight classes. So these brackets you made, they were what, 24 by 36 inches, something like that.
Yep.
And you were watercoloring them.
Yep.
And they're all different animals. They were just beautiful. And I know of a lot of wrestlers that, like, that's the one thing that they held on to from all of high school, is that wrestling bracket.
Yeah, I was adding it up the other day. I graduated in 78, and Don Cosgrove was my football coach. And it wasn't maybe 4, 5, 6 years after that he hit me up about that. And so they call it the Cosgrove Invitational.
Right.
And I've been doing them ever since.
Yeah. Pretty cool.
Tried to get out of it a few times.
Well, I can't imagine how many hours you put into that.
Well, I told him, when my son graduates, I'm done.
Yeah.
And that didn't work.
Yeah.
But I did pare it down. It was 14 original watercolors.
Mm-hmm.
And I started spending more time on one.
Yeah.
And then we copy them.
Yeah.
So now they all have the same painting.
Yeah. Did that actually save you time, or do you just put all that time into the one?
Well, if I would do what I say I'm going to do, I'd start now. After last year, I was thinking about that. I'm just going to go set it up on the easel, and I'm just, every time I walk by there, I'm going to dial that thing. And,
yeah.
And I am going to do that, but I just haven't started it yet.
And watercolor is definitely a medium that you can do that.
Oh, yeah.
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 You can take one brush stroke and call it quits for the day.
And it helps to walk away from it, you know.
It does.
Watercolor, taxidermy, any art, you get blind-eyed to it, struggling, and somebody will walk out there going, you know, like on a taxidermy mount, like, well, that ear's lower than that ear.
Yeah.
And you don't see it because you're in the fight, you know.
It happens to everybody in whatever they do, and I find it in industries a lot too, and some of the brands that I work with. A good example is Benchmade came out with this knife called the Flyway, and they made it for cleaning birds. It's like that's not what that's for. Like, you made the first hunting scalpel, and that's what I've been looking for, you know, because if I have to take my meager skills and cape something, I need a scalpel to do it. And it's a tremendous knife. And when I was talking with them about it, they're like, you know, that just didn't really come up. So here's this thing that they were just too close to understand, you know, how else it could be used. If I'm writing something, if I'm writing an article, I can work on it every day for a week. And then I'll be like, oh, okay, it's as good as I can get it. The deadline's here.
Yep.
Send it out. It'll get published. I'll read through it again. And it's just a train wreck. I'm like, how did I miss that? But you just get too close to it and you can't see it anymore.
Well, have you ever been out hunting and you have somebody with you and they've got the tag, you don't, and there's a big buck right there, and you're like, right there, see? He's right there. Well, you get that tunnel vision.
Right.
And it's kind of the same thing.
Yeah.
You're just too close to your work.
Yeah, and even guys like that you hunt with a lot and who are good hunters and like they know the deal, they'll get excited. And like my buddy Sean, we were on a coyote hunt that we were filming last year, and Sean guides in Alaska. You know, he's hunted his whole life. He's a dialed in dude, and we've filmed a lot of hunts together. We communicate well. And this coyote popped up, and Sean saw it, and I didn't. And he goes, right there. I was like, right where, Sean? And he goes, it's on the rocks. I'm like, we're in a canyon. There's rocks everywhere. Yeah,
which one?
and guys will do stuff like that. And afterwards, he's like, man, I am so sorry about that. But guys will be like, it's right next to the tree. Like, we're in the forest. You know, that doesn't help me. So I always go big to small. And as soon as I start glassing, I start practicing that with people. Like, okay, if I say the dead tree on the skyline, like that's what I'm talking about. You see that? Like, you see the tip of that mountain come down the saddle to the left. You see that? And then, you know, you start big to small, and you can walk people into something in 10 or 15 seconds. And if you haven't sort of built out like a common language for everything that you're looking at.
Yeah. Or the terminology, like I hunted with a guy from Nevada, and he came up here, and we were elk hunting, and we hunted more than 1 year. But the first year I hunted him, I'd be pointing something out to him. I said, see that snag?
Yeah.
And he's like, yeah. I go, get to the left of that snag. Do you see that? You see it? And I could tell he doesn't see it.
Right.
You know, he's like nodding his head, yes, but he does not see it. And this went on for a few days. And after, it was like 3 or 4 days into the hunt, he's like, Dan, what's a snag?
Yeah.
I'm like, are you kidding me? Well, they don't have trees down there.
Sure.
He didn't know what it was.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's an easy thing. And, you know, some language that might be really common to us, like tamarack, right? If there's one tamarack on the hill, I can be like,
yep,
Dan, it's right underneath the tamarack. And you'll be like, boom. You go, you know, to the other side of the Continental Divide, and they might call it a large. You know, they might not have it. So like you're just speaking gibberish.
It really pops when you're hunting with somebody that you're both on the same page.
Oh man.
And when, you know what the other one's thinking, much less speaking,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And you do get really clicked in. Like, you know, if I'm hunting with Kyle Nye or Jim O'Leary, they'll see something and they can be 10 yards away from me and go bear. And I'll look at them, and then I can look at the point on the hillside that that animal is at.
Yep.
And I think that that's just because we've hunted together so much. You know each other's body language, what they're thinking about. And you get in tune in ways that are difficult to describe.
It's a cool thing about hunting. I mean, it's an unspoken camaraderie that you're...
Yeah.
You don't even talk about it. You just do it.
We were talking about this hyena skull when I was in Tanzania. We were hunting with Swahili trackers, and they didn't talk at all while they were tracking. But they were communicating perfectly, but they would not utter a word. And so much of what I saw from them, I can't describe. You know, it reads to me as superhuman. But those guys were also illiterate. So for me to go through a page of a book, you know, that would be as foreign to them as, you know, them looking at the ground. And there was a time, Dan, that we jumped a herd of a couple hundred head of buffalo, and they took off through the brush in a big swarm. And those guys went out there and found the track from the bull that we're looking at and stayed on it. And I didn't believe it at all. I thought I was getting some kind of razzle-dazzle nonsense. And this herd ended up, we bumped them a lot of times. This herd ended up fracturing until we were down to about 10 animals. And then they came through a little lane in the trees there, and that bull was with them. And those guys had been right. How you pick out one bull track out of a herd of buffalo when there's a bunch of bulls in there.
That's amazing.
It's so incredible. You know, they're looking, and he wasn't in the back when they took off. So it's not like his track was the one that was on top. You know, I can't understand that. They're seeing things that I can't see.
Well, it's like as an archery hunter, been through that so many times that try and find that one bull.
Yeah.
And it's difficult.
It is.
They're doing it in a herd.
Yeah.
Unreal.
You know, but their lives were a lot more focused than ours. You know, that's it for them.
You know, not to get too far out on a tangent, but on the news I saw where a plane wreck in Colombia, there was four children that lived out there in that jungle for 40 days.
Isn't that amazing?
And the way they found them was trackers.
Yeah.
They were natives. Yeah. I mean, they knew what to eat, what not to eat, but they were finding little kid footprints in the,
wow.
It just went on and on, and they finally found them.
Wow. Yeah, tracking is such an incredible art form and so enjoyable too. A lot of the tracking that we end up doing as hunters is clouded with stress and doubt because a lot of times it's after you've shot something.
Yeah.
And that feeling is not a good one. It's not an optimistic feeling when you're tracking something.
No, it makes you want to quit hunting when you know, it's the roller coaster of emotions that you can be so high and then so low.
I really encourage people to go out in the snow in easy tracking conditions and track an animal backwards. So go cut a trail instead of following it where it's going, go back to where it's been, because then you know the end of the story and you can start to piece it together a little bit better. Mm-hmm. And you also aren't going to bump that animal and change its behavior. You can see what its life was like up until that point.
Yeah.
And that's a low stress, high curiosity, like really fun way to learn about tracking that's a lot more accessible. And like, take your kid out there. I have never met a kid that doesn't think tracks are cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I do that with my grandkids. They're, I'm constantly schooling them.
Yeah.
You know, what's that?
I bet they love it.
Yeah.
Yeah. My nephew Hank he'll be very confident in his analysis of a track. But, yeah. When did you start doing taxidermy?
1986.
Yeah. That's the year I was born.
Is it?
Yep. So that's a long time. How has the game changed during that time? Forms have gotten better.
They're yeah, very, very much improved. But back in 86, I was interested. I was hunting, you know, and I took some stuff to a taxidermist, and it was horrible.
Yeah.
The mounts were horrible. And
nothing worse.
I thought, I've been doing art my whole life.
Yeah.
I can figure this out.
Yeah.
And there was a Northwest School of Taxidermy pamphlet deal. And you could tell by the illustrations and the printing, it was like made in the 50s.
Yeah.
And it was a correspondence course. I ordered that. And so they'd give you, every month they give you an assignment, mm-hmm. you know. And the first thing I mounted was a Mallard Drake. And it was so bad that their necks are pretty skinny compared to their heads.
Yeah.
And I couldn't figure out how in the world am I going to turn this inside out. So I cut it down its throat,
uh-huh.
got the thing mounted, and then I had to stitch that up, and that looked really good. And then I had his feet mounted too far back to where I had to put a counterweight on it or he'd tip over. That was my first mount.
Nice.
And the second mount was a cougar. So I skipped the squirrel thing.
Cats are, I think, as far as what we deal with in North America, they've got to be the hardest because they're the ones that I most often see as the worst.
Yeah, I agree. And I've focused on that.
Yeah.
So
where do people go wrong with cat mounts?
So if you order a mannequin and you mount on that mannequin without doing any facial alterations, you're probably not going to be happy with it.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I've seen so many cats in my life that, you know, run hounds, and I've seen hundreds of them.
Yeah.
And I've mounted hundreds of them now, but they have, I think the ones you're talking about, you see, you instantly don't like it.
Yeah.
Are, they have that, like, deer in the headlights look, or,
yeah.
you know, they don't get the brow over the top of the eye, which, when you think about it, those cats are constantly fighting. They need that early detection of a SWAT, so their eyes are not bugged out.
Right.
They're in.
Yeah.
And the eye width. Seems like most of those mannequins, the eyes are too far apart. And I'll cut it and I'll move it.
Mm.
Of course, I base it off of with the skull measurement and all that. But I'm getting to where I'm pretty comfortable with them.
Yeah.
I took one to the World Show and competed it there in 07, and it got first place in the professional division. But
so how many cats would you be up against in something like that?
You're up against all mammals, not just cats.
Oh, really? That's not easy.
I don't even remember how many cats were there, but you're mainly competing against
white-tailed bucks.
Well, it'd be life size.
Oh, it's
not
life size
shoulder
stuff.
Mount.
Okay.
So they have categories like it's getting so competitive now that they'll have early season whitetail shoulder mount, late season whitetail shoulder mount. Because you know, you think about what's harvested in this country the most, it's whitetails.
Yeah.
And so they got to break it apart. And but that cougar I competed was against all other. It came down between a gal from Australia, and she had a wallaby, and mine, and So it's an amazing experience. It was the first time they'd ever had it in the Western United States.
Okay,
they alternate Europe, U.S., Europe, U.S. every year. And it's always back east.
Yeah.
And then I saw it was going to be in Reno, Nevada. I'm like, I got to go.
Yeah.
And yeah, it was a fun trip.
So the best mount in the world in 07, that's quite an accomplishment.
Well, I was probably just the best guy that showed up that day.
Yeah.
I mean, I look at it that way. It's a learning tool. If you go with the right attitude, and I started mounting in 86, And I competed in 87 and state level, you know. Yeah. And if you go seek that judge out with your scorecard and you say, hey, can you come give me a critique? And he won't do it unless you ask him.
Right.
And then he'll come over there and he'll give you his thoughts, like, you know, and they're kind. the first competition I went to, I took, my mentality was more is better. I took 4 mounts.
Oh, wow.
And that judge says, you know, you might want to just concentrate on one.
Yeah.
And yeah. dial it.
Yeah.
And I walked out of that competition with nothing.
Yeah.
I didn't win anything.
Well, I mean, you don't walk out with nothing if you learn something from it.
Yeah.
And competition is such a healthy thing. And that's why it's illegal to have a monopoly in business. Because if you control everything, then you stop getting better. And it takes a lot of humility to go to a judge and say, hey, I want this to be better, and I'd love for you to tell me how.
Yeah. And they want to tell you.
Yeah.
You know, and it's the best. When I first started, there was a fellow hound dogger that was very good at taxidermy.
Yeah, because he'd seen a lot of lions.
Oh, yeah. And he's an artist.
Yeah.
And I spent 2 weeks at his house just taking me fast track through the School of Hard Knocks. And it got me on the right track.
Yeah.
And then I started competing. And he was the judge at that first state competition I went to. And I thought, man, he's my buddy. I'm going to kick everybody's ass.
Yeah.
Nope.
Wrong.
Nope.
Yeah. When I ask people for criticism, it's my closest friends who will actually do it. A lot of people will just say, good job.
Yeah.
I like it. And I can't do anything with that.
Yep.
It's something that I learned in college. My degree was literature and writing. So I was constantly writing stuff. And there are some classes that people just wanted to be really positive and encouraging. And I didn't grow in those at all. The classes that had people that were just cutthroat and brutally honest, like, you'd feel like you're about to start crying in public because you'd worked really hard on something and it just got ripped to shreds. But even though it feels personal to get criticized, it almost never is.
Yeah.
not on something that you worked on.
I had that happen to me on I met a UPS deal in Portland. We all were on these committees, and I was down there, and everybody said, stand up and say your name and what you like to do and where you live. And I heard taxidermy across the room, and I'm like, huh. And so when it came my turn, I told him, and he sought me out at the break time, and
yeah.
We became good friends. And he asked me to stop by his house on the way home, and he did that. He had those mounts on the wall, and he's like, what do you think? And I go, that's a big buck. No, I mean, what do you think of the mount?
Yeah.
And I go, where'd you get that buck? And I mean,
yeah.
I just kept dodging
right.
it
yeah.
and dodging it. And anyway, we became good friends, and he started going to the competitions with me. And
yeah.
and he won best of category. And so I finally fessed up and I said, well, it looks like he's been eating licorice.
Yeah.
You know, your paint job's way too black. I mean, sure, in Africa, they have pretty black skin, but not around here.
Right.
And if you really look at it, it's not black.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a shade of brown, right?
Yep.
Yeah, there's almost no blacks in nature at all.
Yep, and there's also no straight in nature.
Right.
That's another thing that has stuck with me is everything's got a curve.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Show you this knife here. I just got to build that with a guy in Montana named Thomas Rucker, and he won International Blade of the Year twice. And I asked him the same thing that I'm about to ask you, which is when you're preparing a knife for an international competition like that, what's the difference between how you make every other knife? And he said, almost nothing. So if you're preparing a piece of taxidermy for a competition, what's the difference between what you're doing to that mount and a deer that I dropped off at your house?
The difference is time.
Yeah.
And, you know, your average... They call it commercial taxidermy and competition taxidermy. And if the guy wants to pay for a competition mount, then so be it.
But yeah.
Most people don't see the difference.
Yeah.
But a judge will. Yeah. Those judges are, that's their jobs, find something wrong with it. They got a mini mag flashlight and magnifiers, and they're looking up the nostrils and down in the earbuds, and they're trying to find something. Because a perfect score would be 100, mm-hmm. and it's a score sheet, and it's categorized like into different categories on the mount, and their job's to find something wrong with it. Mm-hmm. And so if you look at it that way before you ever leave your shop, if you have any reservation about that thing, you're going to get hammered.
Yeah.
So, God, that world show, I was stopping at rest areas and going back there in the trailer, and I was still screwing with it.
That's funny. So you get a mannequin now, and it's basically rigid foam, right?
Yep.
So you can carve into that foam and take stuff out of it, but you're also going to put some clay on top of it to modify different portions of it, right?
Right.
Let's say, you know, the, you know, most popular mount in the country, let's call it a whitetail buck. I don't know if that's true, but there's sure a heck of a lot of them. What's your favorite part of that mannequin to modify to make it stand out so that that person's deer mount doesn't just look like a deer, but it looks different from all the other deer mounts?
So when they sculpt those, you have to think about it. They're putting stuff on that mannequin to appeal to the human eye, to the potential buyer of that. He's going to be like, wow, look at all that facial definition. Mm-hmm. A lot of that don't show on, like if it's a long haired cape, it won't show.
Right.
So I take a knife and I'll cut it and I'll accentuate the like the masseter muscles along the jaw or wherever I want to. And you think, well, that you're overdoing it, but you're not, because once you have the thickness of that skin, the hair, it gets subtle on you, and it'll just pop that mount rather than mount it on the stock mannequin.
Mm-hmm. And it sticks out to everybody, whether they know what they're looking at or not. Like you can see a really good deer mount and be like, wow, that pops to my eye. There's also some that are a little bit overdone with some of that detail work, and they've kind of got an Arnold Schwarzenegger jaw.
I was just going to say, they're the Arnold Schwarzenegger mount, and I've seen them at competitions like, I'm curious what the judge is going to say about that, and they usually get hammered on it.
It's just a bit much. So, you know, you're dealing in subtleties. Another thing that you're having to deal with is guys that are handing you capes that they haven't done a very good job of cutting off of an animal.
Oh, yeah.
So this is a huge thing that I wanted to talk about. If somebody thinks that they're going on a hunt that they have the potential of shooting something that they want to have mounted, should they talk with you beforehand to see how you want that cape cut? Should they get instructions from you? Is there a general way or general advice that you could give to people on how to cape an animal on a hillside so that their taxidermist can do a good job?
Well, I have brochures that have a diagram on there with the dotted line on where to make your cuts, but that gets complicated. They have to, a lot of these people don't know they're bringing it to me until they kill it.
Right.
So that's impossible.
Yeah.
You know, one of the best capes I got in was a guy was in the Eagle Cap and, he Googled it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he pulled up Boone and Crockett and it had that on there and it was perfect.
Yeah.
But it's just a hard thing to control that end of it. And they all, not all of them, but most of them have defects, knife cuts, hopefully not bullet holes, but a lot of times.
Yeah. And you can fix some of that.
Yeah, you can fix it. You know, most of it.
Yeah.
I mean, it becomes, I wouldn't mount it if I didn't know it would look good.
Right.
I'd just be like, ah, it's junk. We can't do that.
So back to my Cape Buffalo, right? They're lining through the trees and we climb up on this termite mound, this great big termite mound, like 8 feet off the ground, something like that. And I can see them filing through and there's a gap in the trees, and the PH is standing right next to me, and he goes, "You ready?" I was like, "I am, like, I couldn't be more ready." And he goes, "Cow, calf, young bull, cow." And then the bull that I wanted was coming through, and he said, "Shoot." And on the shoot, that 375 H&H was ripping its way down there. And I shot him through both lungs, maybe 75 yards away, 300 grain bullet, swift A-frame, like plenty of energy going that way.
And he ran off?
No. Oh. He stopped and looked at us like I owed him money. And then he ran straight towards us. So I racked around and I tried to shoot him in the forehead, and I about blew his right horn off. And then I shot him in the guts, and then I shot him in the neck. And the PH goes, "May I join you?"
Yes, absolutely.
And he shot and he spined him at, you know, 11 yards away or something. And I reloaded and, you know, shot him three or four more times because that felt like the right thing to do. And we walked over there and saw, you know, everything that had just happened. Saw this broken horn. And he goes, "Don't worry about that. The taxidermist can fix that for you." It's like, fix what? Like, this is part of the story.
Uh-huh.
So if we go walk in the house right now and look at that thing, you can see where a 375 H&H ripped through his right horn.
Yep.
Now, people will shoot elk antlers, deer antlers, and blow them completely in half.
Mm-hmm.
That almost feels like a different thing to me. Or they shoot a mountain goat that ends up breaking its horns as it's rolling downhill. Where do you sort of, is there any ethics for you in drawing the line for like what's part of what this animal is, and then, you know, quote unquote, fixing it?
Well, to me, I can fix any of that.
Yeah.
So it's up to the hunter.
Yeah.
It's like, does it mean a lot to you to have that show?
Right.
Or do you want me to make it go away?
Yeah. And what if it had like a broken tine from fighting or something like that, and they wanted you to rebuild that?
If it was obviously there before,
yeah,
I wouldn't have a problem with that. I mean, yeah. It was there,
right?
You know, I won a big buck contest one time, a situation like that
at the mill.
Uh-huh.
Nice. So the big buck competition at the mill, there was a little buck competition too, if I remember right.
Yeah, because I remember the guy pulled it out of his front pocket. I'm like, are you kidding me?
That's too funny. Yeah. Tell me about your big Idaho deer.
He was, I had hunted that unit probably four or five times with other people.
Mm-hmm.
And I just kept putting in, you know, they don't do points over there, and never that guy.
Yeah.
And then I finally drew it. And so I knew what was in there.
Yeah.
And went over there and had some help. In fact, that the first trip over there, there was some friends of mine took another vehicle, and they were on that side of the unit, and we were on this side of the unit, and we just split up and just glassing, and we never saw anything to get too excited about. And then it was time to go back to work, and then I went back over, and buddy Adam went with me, and there's a guy I know that lives over there, and I called him, and he said, "I saw one in the velvet early that I think you'd be interested in." So we went down there and we started glassing around, and we couldn't find that buck. I kept quizzing him too, because somebody else's opinion of trophy is not yours.
Right.
And I didn't know. So every buck, decent buck we're seeing, I'm like, "Is that him?" He's like, no, that ain't him.
Yeah.
Okay. And then there was this freak. He was like super tall and super narrow.
Yeah.
And he had non-typical points on. He was a cool buck.
Yeah.
And I go, "Is that him?" He goes, "No, no." I go, "All right."
We're starting to establish a scale for what's big.
So yeah. The next day, we're not doing any good at all. And I go, "I'm going to go shoot that freak." He goes, no, don't do that. And then we were just kind of standing there, and we saw this nice buck. He's a 3x4,
mm-hmm.
and he was rutting does. And I'm videoing him, and I really don't care if he sees me, because I don't plan on shooting him. And he finally did see us. We're moving around freely on the hillside, and he finally did see us, and he took his does and went down and kind of out of sight. And I said, you know what? We haven't been to the end of this ridge. Maybe we should walk down there. And Cody grabbed the spot and scope on the tripod, and instead of putting it away, he just packed it. Mm-hmm. And he's out ahead of me. And you know how it is when you see something, it just draws you right back over there.
Yeah.
I just was curious what that 3x4 was going to go do.
Yeah.
Because he saw us.
Right.
And so I just kept looking over there, and I kept looking over there, and I'm looking 500 and some yards in that purple brush on the hillside, and I could see that white muzzle on a buck. You know, that just tells you that's a buck.
Right.
And I go, hey, Cody, stop. I go, make sure that's that 3x4, will you? See it in that purple brush? He sets it up, and he just goes, oh, my God, come here. And that was that whopper. He was there the whole time.
Wow.
And so I laid down there, and here I'm getting schooled by he's by 30.
Yeah.
And I'm laying down there, and it's 550 yards. He goes, can you shoot that far? I go, I don't know, but I think I don't know. He goes, he doesn't even know we're here. He goes, let's just wait and see what he does. And it's good advice.
Yeah.
Because he started rutting these does and down. He was 1,500 yards down there, and I thought, oh, my God, I hope I see him again. Mm. He got down there and bedded down. We just crossed this cheatgrass bowl wide open. I mean, he could see us. We were just moving like shadows, and we got on the blind side of that ridge, just took off down, making up time, got down there, and I had to pop up over to see. You know how it is. You lose your visual. It's like, did I go too far? Am I not far enough? I don't know. I'm going to look. So I popped up there, and there's a doe looking at me. And I jumped back, and Cody goes, you see him? I go, no, there's a doe standing there. He goes, not the buck? And I go, hang on a second. And I got back up there, and I could see the yellow grass was probably 3 feet tall. And I could see that rack in that grass. He was bedded down 75 yards from me, looking the other way.
Yeah.
And I pulled down there, and you talk about the fear of failure.
Yeah,
because if I'd have blown that,
yeah,
the next time I saw him, he'd have been across a draw, around a rim rock, hauling ass. And I remember I was shaking.
Yeah.
And I took the sling and put it on my elbow and tightened things up. And finally, I pulled the trigger, and Cody's giving me bad time afterwards. He goes, I didn't think you were ever going to pull the trigger. And I go, dude.
Yeah, I'm having a stroke over here.
Oh, man. But that was amazing, amazing buck.
Yeah. How big did he end up being?
216.
Yeah. And he's beautiful.
Yeah.
Yeah. Who did you have mount him?
I checked on the internet.
Okay. What happens? Is there?
That was a funny story about that one, James.
Okay.
I took it and competed it.
You did?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I made the rock that I mounted the buck on the rock. It was a wall mount.
Yeah.
It was a Shape of Idaho.
Oh, that's cool.
And I was packing them in there separately. I was packing this rock in there, and this guy, I walked by this guy, and he goes, where did you find that? And I'm just like, he thinks it's a real rock.
Uh-huh.
I go, they're hard to find, but you keep looking.
Yeah. This one was in Utah.
Yeah.
Strangely. Yeah. That is funny. No, making those scenes, those habitats, what's the right word for that?
Habitat.
Yeah. That's another thing that it seems like a lot of taxidermists kind of just punt into the bleachers a little bit. And it looks like they're just standing on styrofoam.
That's another thing. Getting back to the competition thing, is you'll get judged on that.
Mm-hmm.
And not just how well you did it, but you bring the art back into it, and there's design, there's composition, there's balance.
Sure.
You can overpower that mount with habitat.
Yeah.
So you want a less is best type of deal. But it has to have balance. Like, I wish I knew the terminology. It's a Japanese term. It's basically, land, water, sky, and you don't want things bigger up here than they are down here.
Right.
Cause it looks like it's going to tip over.
Yeah.
So you have to kind of keep all that into consideration, but I get a kick out of those habitats. That cougar I took down there to the World Show, I had as many hours on that tree as I did the cat.
Yeah.
I made an aspen tree.
How did you do it?
I took many hours driving my UPS truck to Troy, thinking, just running it through my head. And I wanted that, just like I just said, the design and composition. I wanted a Z. Mm-hmm. I didn't want a straight tree.
Right.
And so I made it out of steel.
Mm-hmm.
And then I wrapped that steel with chicken wire. And then I blew it full of foam, so it's coming out through the chicken wire.
Yep.
And then I rasp it off, and then I went and finished the tree that way, the bark. With,
yeah.
And so I got to make it the way, and then I plugged real aspen limb ends into it.
Yep.
And then the artificial foliage, and yeah, it was, I get a kick out of it. It's fun. Yeah.
And stuff like that makes such a huge difference, too.
Yeah.
Is there a good method for how taxidermy should move through generations? You know, I've heard that come up with people before, that, you know, if they get towards maybe the end of their hunting career, they've got all this taxidermy and they're like, who's going to want this stuff?
I know.
Is that a question that people should be asking themselves earlier, or is there a good way out of it?
There isn't, as far as I know. It's a chronic problem with families, because he may have been the only one that wanted to hunt. Now mm-hmm. he's got this huge trophy room, and what do you do with it? You can sell it,
yeah,
but pennies on the dollar.
Sure, yeah, you're not making money off the deal.
Yeah,
yeah, no, that is a tricky thing. Do you do anything with European mounts, or is it all taxidermy?
We were doing all the Europeans there. Toss was doing them. Mm-hmm. It cracked me up one day. She's all got this rubber suit on and goggles, and she's out there with a pressure washer, and she's got brain matter in her hair, and she's like, I'm 60 years old. I don't need to be doing this shit.
She's doing a lot of your fleshing, isn't she?
She used to, but she was doing all the Euros.
Uh-huh.
And then I finally went, all right. And so I started getting Lauren Hull out in the Grand Ronde Valley to do them. And
yeah, Lauren does all my Euros. She does a tremendous job.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That chandelier in there, I just stare at that every time I go in her shop.
It's so cool.
She said she won't sell it. I don't want to buy it. I don't have the money for it. But she said somebody offered her 10 grand for it. She said no.
Yeah. Yeah, there's like 400 or 500 coyotes in a chandelier.
Yep.
Yeah. I like a lot of the stuff that she's done, piecing different animals together.
Yeah.
You know, taking a bat and a snake and something else, and then turning them into a dragon. Like that stuff is so incredible, and she pulls it off in a way that's like, that looks like a real skeleton.
Yeah.
Like that's an animal that I didn't know existed. What is this? And it's pretty cool. She's an interesting gal, and definitely
got the passion for it.
Yep.
Yep.
Yep. She does a good job on skulls. I love it all. I love skulls. You know, the studio here, of course, is full of them, but a good shoulder mount, I mean, there's just nothing like it.
Yeah.
Yeah. What are some other things that hunters can be doing to make sure they're bringing you a good cape, besides making the initial cuts correctly?
Well, bacteria loves warm, wet. Mm. So I always tell people, you know, like say they're going to do a float sheep hunt on the John Day or Deschutes. Do not put that thing in plastic.
Yeah,
that's the worst thing you could do. And they're not that fragile, really. If you keep that in mind, don't, like, in a cooler, say they got ice in that cooler, and over the day or two it's melting down. Now they got water in there. So worst thing they can do is put that cape in there.
Yeah.
Because it'll just sit in that water.
Right.
But if you keep it fairly dry, that they actually aren't that fragile. You can get away with 3 or 4 days, and I don't want to tell people that, but... Because it'd be a tragedy to lose a sheep cape. I used to give those seminars down there at the Dalles,
mm-hmm.
For people that drew sheep and goat tags. And that's what I always tell them. Just, you know, it's not that scary. Just keep it out of the water.
Yeah.
And try and cool it out.
Yeah.
You know, the best thing they could do is work it up. But a lot of people aren't schooled in how to.
When you say work it up, you mean fleshing it? Do you mean turning ears?
Well, it's like when we were doll sheep hunting in Alaska, there's a lot of downtime in camp, and I just worked everybody's sheep up right there.
Yeah.
And turning the ears, splitting the lips,
yeah,
getting rid of all the red meat. And
turning ears gives me panic attacks.
Yeah.
Like, I'll, you know, when I'm doing these spring bear hunts in some of these river wildernesses, I'm bringing a 50-pound bag of salt with me, and I'll flesh it and salt it, and I'll pack everything with salt, and I'll pop toes out and stuff like that. But ears just stress me out.
Yeah.
I need to sit down with somebody like you that knows what they're doing to show me sometimes so that I can get over that fear. Cause there's times that I'm going to be out there another 6 days.
Yeah.
So what am I going to do? Like, I need to work it up.
And that's another thing to point out is the salting of that hide. You definitely do not want to salt something that's not fleshed.
Yeah.
Because it just locks that red meat right onto there. And then I get it.
Yeah.
And I put it, I go out in the salt room and I put it on the beam and I can't get it off there.
Yeah.
Because it's dehydrated.
Yeah. Dale gave me a talking to about that when I didn't have a bear fleshed out quite right and I salted it. But bears are tough. You know, they've got pretty thin skin.
Yeah.
It's real easy to cut through it
in and they,
a few different places.
The bacteria seems to be a prevalent on a predator.
Yeah.
Like, they're always digging in something dead or whatever, yeah. So they got all that on them.
And you can take a raw elk hide and tack it up on a barn wall, and it'll probably still be there with quite a bit of hair left on it in 3 or 4 years.
Yeah.
You try and pull that off with a bear, and it's going to disintegrate in the first warm month.
It's that grease and,
yeah,
and bacteria.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that grease is tough. I mean, you're just running your knife over that and just pushing grease and fat out of over and over and over again. It seems like there's no bottom to it.
Yeah. Yeah. They'll actually grease burn if you leave it on there. And bears are tough.
Yeah.
Of all the animals that I deal with, if there is a slippage problem, like the tannery will call me up and say, hey, we got a problem with this bear. It's always a bear.
Yeah.
And it's hardly ever do I ever have an elk slip or a deer slip. It's them bears.
Antelopes slip pretty easy, don't they?
They can. Yeah, they can.
I mean, guys are hunting them during warm months.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's another thing. I always take a cooler with me, and it's going, that's where that antelope's going to go. There's no food in there. There's no beer in there. That's where it's going to go. And I've never had a problem, but,
yeah.
Speaking of that, I drew one this year.
Did you really?
Yeah.
Congratulations.
Yeah.
That's a big deal in Oregon.
Yeah.
How many years have you been applying?
So I was in the middle ground there where I knew I wasn't going to draw a rifle tag, and they came up with this new this year, a muzzleloader hunt.
Mm.
And I had 13 points and okay. I drew it.
Cool.
So down Steens.
Nice. That'll be fun.
Yeah.
Go sweat it out in a ground blind.
Yeah.
Yeah, that'll be cool. I drew a white-tailed doe tag with 3 preference points.
Nice.
The guys from the Midwest, I talked to them about that, and they're like, what are you talking about? Like, it's hard to draw a white-tailed doe tag here.
If it is. Well, I've got a tag I've been trying to draw down by Umatilla.
Mm-hmm.
It's in the doe section, the 600 series, and it's I don't think you can shoot a doe on it. It's but you can shoot a buck on it.
Yeah.
And I've got 27 points for that.
Wow, 27 years of applying for
yes.
that tag.
I just there's only 3 tags.
Huh.
So there's no turnover, but
yeah.
Unreal.
That's crazy. Well, I hope you hit it one of these days. That'd be cool.
Well, it's like Nevada gave me the middle finger and got 23 bull points down there now.
Hmm.
Every year, it's like Christmas in June, and then you get a lump of coal.
Yeah. Are you putting in for one of those units around Ely or?
Yeah. And I need to either at my age reassess because I'm putting in for the best of the best.
Yeah.
And there's going to come a point where I'm like, oh, I'm going to notch this down a little bit.
Well, there's big bulls and other units.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's like, Colorado. I have an agency that manages all my preference points called The Draw. That way I don't miss any deadlines and they can do all the research on stuff. And, you know, I have a meeting with them at the beginning of the year, tell them, you know, what I want my hunting season to look like. And they just go from there.
Nice.
It's so nice. So I think we're, you know, applying in 16 states every year. And
oh, wow.
Then, you know, based on like whatever I need for filming projects or just experiences or whatever, I can be like, you know, hey, I want to hunt deer in three states this year. But something that they pointed out in Colorado is a lot of guys will stack points trying to get, you know, one of the top end units and they might wait 20 years or more. Colorado produces a 200 inch buck in almost every county in the state. In any 2 year window that you look at, like you can find a big buck in almost any county in Colorado. So, you know, why wouldn't you want to do that every 2 or 3 years and, you know, have seven of those hunts rather than that one. And I understand both mentalities, but I like hunting. I want to go out and I want to have those experiences with my friends and do the thing and, you know, waiting half of a lifetime for a tag, you know, it's probably just not for me.
Yeah. I that's my mentality with around here.
Yeah.
I'm not one of them guys that's banked up into one AHA. I'm in the MNAHA every year.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, last year I did draw a sled, but, like this year I drew that Eagle Cap Zone thing, they call it, but, I just can't wait.
Yeah, and I don't think you really need to. Archery is in an interesting phase of its life right now. You know, we had archery get a little bit of a foothold in the 19-teens with Saxton Pope and Ishii, the last wild Indian. And, you know, that popularity really increased and through the 50s and 60s and 70s, and then compound bows started coming out and, you know, people started learning more about being able to shoot at distance more. Then laser rangefinders came along and we could actually know how far we were shooting. You know, technology's gotten to the point where these bows are just extremely shootable. And if you get a good bow and put a good sight on it and get a good release and a good rest and, you know, you spend an hour or two at a pro shop getting lessons, you can go home and shoot accurately out to, you know, really reasonable hunting ranges.
Yeah.
But I definitely grew up here where guys bow hunted so that they could hunt every year. It wasn't because they just had a passion for archery. They had a passion for hunting, and that was the tag that you could get year in and year out. If you wanted to rifle hunt, you're only going to hunt every few years.
Yeah.
And, you know, with the increase in popularity of Western hunting, it might be more than a few years if you only want to rifle hunt. So while I love shooting a bow and I love practicing with a bow, I don't know that I would bow hunt unless it gave me, an increase in opportunities, which is what it does.
Yeah. The older I get, the less I need to, kill.
Yeah.
And you have a whole different mindset when you're almost rooting for that animal.
Yeah.
And when that situation's perfect, you take him.
Right.
But I will pass on a lot of that stuff.
Yeah.
Those shots, you know, that I used to take.
Yeah.
But,
and you know, now you've got another generation of little hunters coming up that you get to go with, and that changes things a little bit more, doesn't it?
I remember when my kids were that age and I pretty much quit planning on Dan shooting something.
Yeah.
And so I'm going to go through that all over again.
Yeah.
But
it's satisfying in a totally different way.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I get some of that out of guiding. As a guide, you get a lot of, what hunting is, and a few things that are not what hunting is. And, you know, one of the reasons that a lot of people do guide is because it puts them in the woods a lot longer mm-hmm. than if they're just going out for themselves. And you get a little bit of that vicarious enjoyment of somebody else getting to pull the trigger or send that arrow. And you really depend, for me, depending on the person, like some people, I am way happier than they are. Like I am through the moon at whatever their accomplishment is. And then there's other people that, you know, I'm just looking forward to cutting that meet up because I like that part of it.
Yeah.
You know, I'm happy for them and we just had success, but it's not as big of a deal to me. So I think the stage of hunting that I'm in and everybody evolves with it is that now it's not what I'm hunting that I care the most about. It's not where I'm hunting, but it's who I'm hunting with.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I might rather go ground squirrel hunting with my best friends than go Cape Buffalo hunting with somebody that I don't like being around.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Speaking of Cape Buffalo, I've got a bunch of African to do.
Do you?
Yeah.
Cool.
Three Cape Buffalo.
Nice.
The Plains game, wildebeest, all that.
Yeah.
And then a giraffe.
Oh, okay. Are we going to build a second story onto your
remember
building?
That show, Harry and the Hendersons?
Yeah.
I don't know how I'm going to pull that off because my ceiling's 10 feet tall. And I looked on the form book when you order it, and it has the parameters 11 foot 2.
Wow.
So.
Going to do it at an angle.
I guess.
Yeah. That'll be interesting.
Yeah. Those grandkids will get a kick out of that.
Yeah. Yeah. That's really cool. Giraffe is an animal that people have feelings about. You know, a lot of folks think that you shouldn't hunt giraffe, and that's fine. I get that. Those bulls, as they get older, they're no longer breeding, and they get really aggressive towards younger bulls and will kill them. So it's not a good thing to have an old bull giraffe around for any purpose. It's not good for the ecology. It's not good for that population. And there's giraffes that, you know, the best thing that could happen for the totality of the circumstances is for a hunter to go in there and take that animal and then pump a bunch of money into the economy and,
yeah.
and prove out some value for that local wildlife to decrease the conflict with local landowners. Because if you get upset about a white-tailed doe nibbling flowers in your yard, think about what a giraffe might do, you know?
Yeah. I've never been there, but I often thought if I ever do, yeah. A leopard would be the top of my list.
You're a cat guy.
Yeah.
Yeah. There was a leopard killed in camp while I was there by a great big Canadian dude. And I don't know if it was his first leopard or not, but it was a big one and it was a big deal to him. It was a huge deal to the Africans there. They had a whole ceremony and were dancing around and dressed up. And it was a real celebration over that specific animal. But when I looked at it, what I saw was a spotted mountain lion. And it took a lot of what I'd built up in my mind of what a leopard was and brought it home to something, to an animal that I'd been around quite a bit.
Right.
And it was interesting. It didn't make me like love them any more or less, but it more than anything showed me a really interesting connection between our continents, because most of the animals are so dissimilar from what we have mm-hmm. that I couldn't make any parallels. You know, it's such a different world, such a different world. And I was in the Salu Game Reserve area. There's no inhabitants, there's no permanent structures, and it's a big place. And they have the greatest diversity of megafauna in the world. So you'd go over one ridge and you'd see waterbuck, and you go over the next ridge and you see hartebeest, and you go over the next ridge and there's warthogs, and then over here there's hippos and crocodiles, and over here there's elephants, and then there's an eland, and then there's a wildebeest. And they look so different from each other, but they're all in the same habitat. Mm-hmm. It feels like just impossible compared to what we have here. You know, they all look so different from each other, and they're all in the same zone. It was just magical for me. I loved it so much, and I thought it was so special. But the more I was around Cape Buffalo, the more they reminded me of range bulls here, like moo cow bulls. They have the same attitude. They act the same. So hunting for Cape Buffalo for me was a lot like going out on the divide and trying to find one of my dad's bulls that had spent the winter out and was kind of full of himself.
That would be second on my list.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They're cool. They're cool. You know, and I try to talk a good game. Like I wouldn't go hunt buffalo with somebody I didn't like. I'd go hunt buffalo with Jeffrey Dahmer. Like I, if I got another opportunity to go back to Africa, I would take it under almost any circumstances.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I've heard a lot of stories. I got a good friend that's been over there and I think he's shot 4 now.
Yeah.
And he's going again this year.
Yeah.
And the stories he tells me is pretty cool.
It's a vampire bite. Yeah. And the PH told me, because we met in Dar es Salaam before we headed out in the bush, and he goes, "How old are you?" And I told him, and he said, "Stay here. Stay in town. You know, and enjoy Dar es Salaam. You're too young. You're too young to go do this because you're not going to want to do anything else as much ever again." And he might have been right. I made the right decision, but it's difficult to compare any other kind of hunting to the hunting that's available in Africa. And I get a little bit confused by North American hunters who say that they have no interest. And I think that the only real explanation is that they don't understand what it is to be over there and hunt there.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty darn special.
I passed up a trip last year. It was a spouse thing, and my buddy's and his wife went over, and he invited Toss and I, and it was touring the wine, the vineyards and the wine area in Limpopo, and then a buffalo hunt, and then Kruger Park. It sounded like a blast, but oh my God, that was expensive, and so I backed out of it.
It is, but there's also a lot of, like, South African hunts in particular that are much less expensive than an elk hunt. You know, for $10,000 all in, which I'm not scoffing at that amount of money at all. Like I know what it takes to scrap that together. You can go over there and have a really tremendous experience for 10 days and come home with 3 or 4 animals. And, you know, you compare that to, you know, what we can offer as an elk hunt out here where, you know, you're going to grind it out for 7 to 10 days, and there's a good chance you're going to go home with nothing. And I'm not trying to make light of elk hunting either, because that's my bread and butter. But it's more accessible than what a lot of people think. It's just a longer flight.
Yeah.
Yeah. A lot longer flight. They had I flew through the Netherlands when I went. And even though my rifle and ammunition were luggage, so I had no access to them whatsoever, I had to have all this documentation to get through the airport in the Netherlands for my rifle to make it through. So that was the trouble on the way there. And then Ebola was going on while I was there. It was in a completely different part of Africa. But no matter what, we're going to think of Africa as a country and not a continent, you know, we get that wrong. So when I came back, I had 4 different glass room screenings to make sure that I didn't have Ebola. But the Ebola outbreak in Africa was closer to the Netherlands than I was when I was in Africa to the Ebola outbreak. You know, it's just a tremendous distance from one end of that continent to the other.
Giant. Yeah.
It's huge. Even in Tanzania, we flew, I think we were in a Cessna 206. We flew for like 4 hours into the bush just to get to where we were going.
Wow.
Yeah. It's crazy big. Yeah. It's cool though. I don't know. So if you're working on an animal like a buffalo that you haven't seen a whole bunch of times, what's your process for making that correct?
So that process would start with good form selection.
Okay.
And there's multiple companies that sell, but they also have multiple sculptors that work for them. Mm-hmm. And I over the years know who I like.
Yeah.
I like their sculpts. And they don't have to be the newest thing on the market. It's like whitetail deer. The best one, in my opinion, has been around since the 90s. Mm. And they've come out with tons since then, but I still go back to that. I still like that form. And so anyway, you just know who sculpted that. And if you trust that guy,
yeah,
then that buffalo is going to be accurate.
Yeah. Tanneries are a big hang up.
Yeah.
A lot of the frustration that I hear from people with taxidermy is like, well, why isn't it back yet? It doesn't take you all that long to mount, to shoulder mount a deer or an elk, but getting that hide back from the tannery can be really lengthy. How long is that taking these days?
It's even worse now after COVID, but you better plan on 6 months.
Yeah.
And maybe 8.
Yeah.
It's crazy how long it takes.
Yeah.
But I think choosing the right tannery, which I'm with a tannery now, clear back in Michigan. Mm. And I got tired of paying the shipping, so I got swooned over to a tannery in California, and the guy was just bending over backwards for me, really doing a good job. As he was giving me a break on the shipping and all this stuff. And then I started getting bear slipping, and I went back to the Michigan tannery. They're the best.
Yeah.
I mean, they're professional. They acknowledgement of receipt. Every step of the way, they let you know.
Yeah.
And it's I'll just pay the shipping, I guess.
Yeah.
But there are tanneries and closer to home, but I've been I've probably been with half a dozen of them over the years, and this outfit is the best.
Yeah. Texas, I think, does a pretty good job of that communication element. And I really, really appreciate that from them. But I was hunting Axis deer with El Sapo Guide Service down there in December. Axis is probably my favorite animal to hunt, definitely my favorite animal to eat. The hides are gorgeous. They live in places that it's nice to hang out in.
Yeah.
Like they can't handle the cold. And so Axis deer hunting is just a tremendous time. But, you know, we dropped those deer off with this processor. Same thing. They acknowledged the receipt of it. They called and said, hey, you know, your meat's going to be done on this date, and we'll ship it to you. What's a day that you would like to receive it? Let them know that. Said, hey, it just went out the door. Here's a tracking number. Call. Make sure you're going to be home tomorrow. Yep, I'm going to be home tomorrow. Good. Meat shows up. Called again. Want to make sure everything looks good. Like, yep, everything looks great. Really appreciate it. I just got my hides back. I had two Axis deer flat skins done, and probably make something out of them. But they just do a really good job. And that was Rough Creek Taxidermy down there. There's another outfit that, unfortunately, I'm blanking on right now, and they did the same exact thing the previous time that I was there. You know, they communicated the whole way through, and it isn't extra effort, but it's not that much extra effort.
And it's huge on your end.
Huge.
It's customer service, you know, and it is a little bit more of their time, but look what it, you know, you got a positive opinion of it. And
yeah. Well, it's 5 30-second phone calls.
Yeah.
You know, and it'd be 15 seconds if Texans weren't so polite in how they speak. So I do really, really appreciate that. And I think that's a big lesson learned I've gotten from them, and something that I can be doing to improve the way, you know, I communicate with people in any aspect of my businesses.
I agree. Me too. I mean, it means a lot to them when, even if you're giving them no news.
Right.
They want this. They thank you. It's like, well,
yeah, you know, you haven't forgotten about them.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because in their mind, they're thinking about that cougar like every day.
Yeah.
And they're like, well, it's been 9 months. What's going on? If they know that you haven't forgotten about them, and you know this is what the holdup is, and that just smooths everything over.
Yeah.
Yeah. What's your favorite animal to hunt?
Mule deer.
Why?
There's something about, I would much rather shoot a 200-inch mule deer than a 400-inch bull.
Yeah.
There's just something about their, they get to that age class, and they're a whole different critter as far as how smart they are.
Yeah.
I have whitetail hunted. I've never really gotten into that. The last few years I've been muzzleload whitetail hunting, last 4 years, and it's fun,
mm-hmm.
but, there again, hunting a ghost,
yeah.
Used to be like, the eagle cap. When I was young, we'd go up there and every basin you roll into, there's three or four, 4 points.
Yeah.
And you just keep hunting till you find the one you want. And now if you see one, probably ought to think about shooting him.
Yeah.
So I don't know why, but that, I guess that is why, is because it's going away.
It is.
And
sheep get all the love in the world.
Yeah.
You know, when's the last time you saw a picture of a mule deer getting transplanted underneath a helicopter with a whole crew of biologists making sure everything was good about it? Like, it doesn't happen.
I just did that this year. Did I tell you that?
No.
Yeah. They invited me to come down with them. And,
for the sheep deal?
Yeah.
Yeah.
We collared 49 of them in 3 days.
Yeah.
It was fun.
Yeah.
I'm so glad they invited me because I'd never done it before. And just a blast.
I went and helped one of them up here at the sheep pen where they feed them in the wintertime. And we wanted to work up a couple of these sheep, so we shut the door on the pen. And a bighorn ewe is little. That's a small animal. You know, they're like at their shoulder, maybe as high as my hip. And the walls in there were 8 feet tall, plywood walls. And I got in there to try and grab one of these little ewes, and I thought it would be just like grabbing a domestic sheep, you know? And one of these things looked at me all sheepy, bug-eyed, and jumped over the top of me and out over that 8-foot rail. It's like, oh my gosh.
They got springs.
They do. Yeah. They're always looking for a way to die, but they're extremely athletic on the way there. Yeah.
Yeah. And it was amazing. We'd sling them.
Yeah.
When the chopper'd land or drop them, and we'd sling them to the scale. Mm-hmm. That's the first thing you do. And the weight difference between a ewe and a big ram is amazing.
Sure.
I mean, it's 100 pounds.
Yeah. Yeah. They're a completely different animal. What do you think is going to happen with our mule deer? Are they so far declined that they're just going to go away?
I think I have my theory of what would be a remedy, but they'll never do it. For one thing, we're a predator pit.
Yeah.
We've got so many predators that all like to kill deer. And then we got too many tags.
Mm.
And they're just not giving them a chance to rebound.
And those baby bucks are really susceptible to getting shot.
That is one positive thing that ODFW did. I was so happy when they made that archery deer a draw,
mm-hmm.
because all those baby bucks are just gravy to someone that has an elk tag.
Yeah.
And now they gotta think about that before May 15th and actually put it on their card or application card. I think that was a good thing to do.
Yeah, I agree. It wasn't a great thing for, you know, like the bow shops and stuff like that. I think they're hurting from that a little bit. But for the species itself, I do think it's a good thing. And, you know, early season, you know, that first week of August, first week of September, a forked horn mule deer buck that's still in the velvet, that's a really easy animal to walk up to and shoot with a bow.
Yeah.
You know, he might stay right next to the road while you get your bow out of the back seat. And that's a lot of what was going on. That's a lot of what was going on. I drew a good buck tag last year with, I think, 8 preference points. And a buddy of mine who had worked for Wildlife Services for a long time went and flew it with a pilot that he had done Wildlife Services with. And, you know, they had lived in the air together for coyotes and wolves. And they flew all morning and found 4 deer in the unit. And I just made the decision not to go. And I'm not saying that there's only 4 deer in the unit. I'm not saying that at all. But these are 2 really experienced guys at Spot and Wildlife from a Super Cub, and they weren't able to turn up deer in the sage flats, in the ag fields. And my buddy got back, and he's like, look, found 4 of them. One of them's a decent buck, but it's pretty grim out here. And that was a really tough decision for me. You know, I don't want to throw away 7 years of my hunting life like that, but I also just couldn't bring myself to add to the problem.
Right. And that's why I've been whitetail hunting. See, for some reason, those whitetails are doing better.
Yeah.
And,
well, they're welfare deer. They live down here on the ag land, where they get the protection of people being around. And, you know, they don't have to go up in the mountains in the summer and scrap it out with the lions and the wolves and the bobcats and coyotes and every other thing that wants to kill them. So, yeah, they just live down here on alfalfa, and they can survive better because of it.
A good indicator is I spent a lot of time on that lake kokanee fishing and almost daily, you know, and it used to be that moraine, that East Moraine, just loaded with mule deer.
Right.
You don't see any of them up there.
No. And I don't see that the habitat has changed.
No.
That's what gets thrown out there. Like, well, this is a habitat issue. Like, maybe in some cases, but there are plenty of places in this area where the habitat is very much intact. It has not changed. None of these deer are starving to death. Like, there is an ample amount of food out there that is not getting eaten by anything anymore. You know, I take these Hell's Canyon trips, and I might see 5 or 6 deer in a week down there. And then I look back at some of the records from, like, when Papa Doug was guiding down there, he'd have 40 buck hunters come in, and all of them would shoot a 4-point buck. Like, it was a factory. It was a factory for deer. And Idaho is doing a lot better. They've still got problems, but one of the big differences in Idaho is they treat their predators a lot different than we do.
Predator control, that's got to be, you know, you go out here in Chesnem unit and compare that to straight across the river.
Mm-hmm.
There's no comparison.
No, no.
It's got to be the predators.
You can even look at it with calf recruitment in the elk. And you can go down there in, you know, early spring and see 300 head elk on this side and 200 head of elk on this side. And the Idaho side might have 20 or 30 calves per 100 cows. And you look at the Oregon side, like, well, there's 6 calves per 250 cows. You know, it's these single digit calf recruitments. What'll end up happening is just a complete collapse of the herd once all those animals age out that are adults.
Something needs to happen sooner than later. And our management here, from what I understand, they're seeking a new district biologist. I don't think they've got one yet.
Yep. Yeah, and the gal that's in there right now, she was really reasonable.
She doesn't want it, though.
No.
She's got a good head on her shoulders, but from what I understand, she doesn't want it.
Nope. She's out. Yeah, she's out. And when I met her and it's kind of got to know her a little bit more, I was like, oh, I don't know what your future in this agency is going to be like. And it's kind of an ugly thing to say that if somebody's reasonable and is willing to listen to anybody about a subject, that's not the right attitude, to make it there. It's a sad thing to say, but it is something that we've kind of seen more than once.
Yeah.
Yeah. So hopefully whoever we get, is great. You know, that would be really nice if we got a good district biologist and got a, you know, a modern modern Vic Coggins that really cared and was willing to work with everybody. That'd be cool.
And that's that internal knowledge of, seems like in this day and age, they'll hire somebody out of Florida or New York or, Vic had that knowledge of deer, elk, sheep.
Yeah.
And managed it for 50 years.
Yeah. And saw a lot of changes during that time. And stayed pretty adaptable. And I don't agree with everything that Vic did, but I don't agree with everything that anybody does.
No.
Myself included. what are we missing? Anything else that you wanted to hit on that I haven't got a chance to bring up yet?
Oh, I don't think so. I figured you were going to be challenged to get so you probably have to delete the whole episode because it's so boring.
we actually don't edit very much. it's kind of just the conversation as it happens. But Emily does a great job of making sure we sound smart.
Yeah.
All right, Dan. Well, I really appreciate your time. If somebody wants to get your services as a taxidermist, how do they get a hold of you?
I'm on Facebook. I'm on. I have a website. Just about the referral in Joseph, Oregon is amazing.
Yeah.
Grocery store. They all know where I'm at.
Right. So what's the business called?
Moncrief Wildlife Artistry.
Okay. Moncrief Wildlife Artistry. So you guys can look at the show notes and you can find links to ways to get there, or you can do a Google search and you can see some images there of the work that Dan's done. And, I can tell you that this is a small community and everybody knows the people that do good business and bad business, and the bad businesses don't get to stay here for very long. And you're not going to find anybody that has anything bad to say about your skills as a taxidermist.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. It's an honor to be here. I listened to quite a few of your episodes.
Thank you.
You're very good at what you do.
Thanks, Dan. Appreciate your time.
You bet.
Thank you all very much for listening. I'm going to keep bringing you these stories from normal people just like you who have done extraordinary things. Everyone is an expert at something, and they have interesting perspectives on life and work and the environment and all of the things that we care about. I'm going to keep bringing that to you. And I want to thank you so much for making this show possible. I also want to thank Emily Bratcher for producing this show. She does a great job editing. Really appreciate her. I want to thank John Chatelain. He did the art for the Six Ranch podcast. And Celia, soon to be Harlander, she digitized that so that we can get it out there on the internet for you. Also want to thank Justin Hay for writing this original music and the beautiful whistling that you're listening to right now. You guys are awesome. Thank you so much. Please keep listening to the show. Write me a review if you feel like it, and just keep doing your thing, and we'll all learn from this together. It's been fun, and you know, we're just getting started.